The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Hello and welcome to The Hearing. I'm Janelle Wrigley, your host for this week's episode. And as a special treat today, I'm actually joined by my fellow host, Becky Annison. Hello, Becky.
Hello. Thank you so much for letting me crash your party.
Well, thank you for joining me. I think this is our first time appearing together in an episode, so I'm very excited to have you with me today. And the reason we'll explain in a minute has to do with the topic of today's episode, which is something called jury nullification. And that is where a jury or even a single juror can decide not to convict somebody during a criminal trial, even when there's very strong evidence of the defendant's guilt. And so for today's episode, I spoke with Professor Glenn Reynolds of the University of Tennessee College of Law about the reasons why jury nullification might happen, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that jurors have this power, and one of the big debates relating to jury nullification, which is should jurors be told that they have this power? And Becky, I think the idea for exploring this topic actually started with you when we were having a conversation about potential themes for future episodes. So I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about what is it that intrigued you about jury nullification?
Oh, yes. Okay, so the thing that I found so intriguing is this secrecy that you've just mentioned, the fact of the secrecy. So I've been a lawyer now for nearly 20 years. And I've done my compulsory criminal law seminars, as everybody who's been to the law school in the UK at that time will have done. And I had never heard of jury nullification, not until there was a spate in the UK of trials, criminal trials of climate protesters. And in particular, at one of these trials, outside the Old Bailey, a woman called Trudy Warner stood holding a sign, which all the sign said was just detail the law of jury nullification. That's the first I'd ever heard of it. And then she was taken to trial for contempt of court for doing that, which is very interesting. And what was, I suppose, ironic or funny is that even I, a lawyer, had never even heard of jury nullification until they decided to take this person to court for telling people about jury nullification, which probably means far more people know about it in the UK than ever did before. But it also made me think, I want to know more about this. What is this secret right, secret process that I'm not aware of in the law?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think for me, when you brought it up, what kind of hooked my interest was thinking, and I did vaguely recall it coming up in crim law when I was in law school, but I think what hooked my interest about it from the US perspective was thinking a little bit about, you know, these highly charged political criminal trials that are going on, whether it's Hunter Biden or Donald Trump, and just thinking about, you know, is it, what if a jury, even if they think the evidence is there of these people's guilt, maybe they just don't want to convict for political reasons. I mean, things are so polarized here right now. So I felt like jury nullification is maybe even more kind of salient in the US right now in these very charged, polarized times. So I thought it could be interesting to explore on the US side as well. So we'll be having a two-episode kind of, I don't know if you can call it a mini-series, a doubleheader, exploring the issue on both the US and the UK side. And today, of course, we have Professor Reynolds. So I'm curious, Becky, kind of what you thought, you know, listening back to the interview with Professor Reynolds, did anything jump out at you as being particularly interesting?
Oh, my first thought was, what an amazing law professor. I wish he had been my law professor. He was so interesting.
I thought so too.
So good at presenting the subject. The other thing that really leapt out at me listening to him talk was the, I suppose, almost like an absence. In the UK, we select juries very differently to the way you select them in the US, I believe, that we don't have voir dire, this idea that you can interview, that the defence can interview jurors to find out what their political beliefs are and things like that, and can deselect them as sort of as a result of that. In the UK, you're selected at random from the voting register. There will be certain legal requirements that can get you disbarred, which happen as an operation of law. And I think the defence can request to see sight of those, but the defence won't get to interview somebody to ask them what their political opinions are, to ask them what they think of legalising certain drugs or any of those beliefs. And it was really interesting to me thinking, well, how might that affect jury nullification, where you have two systems which can, I would imagine, can radically change the makeup of a jury or not.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's, it's fascinating for me to learn that that doesn't exist in the UK, because there's a huge body of law in the US about that whole system and voir dire and how many, you know, the ways that jurors are struck. A lot of it ties back into, you know, America's history with slavery and racism and you know, how do you put together a jury that can be unbiased and what factors can you take into account? So you're absolutely right that those differences, even though jury nullification exists on both sides of the Atlantic, there's very different cultural historical contexts to it on both sides. One thing that I really found interesting about Professor Reynolds' perspective, he also brought up just kind of some class issues around jury nullification. When you think about, you know, undoubtedly people are kind of uncomfortable, I think, or can be uncomfortable with the idea of juries having this power, having this discretion to, even if there's evidence of guilt, to say, you know, we're not going to convict this person. And really interrogating what is that discomfort when so many other players in the judicial system, whether it's the prosecutor or the judge or the, you know, the police, they have enormous discretion themselves to decide what charges to bring against somebody, whether to bring charges at all. And Professor Reynolds has this point of view that there's kind of some class issues at play about the status of the various people in the system and how we're responding to the power that they have. I thought that was just really interesting to think about.
I agree. I listened to that piece with interest. And as he was saying, you know, who gets to decide whether a case is even brought, who gets to decide what the specific charges of that case are from the smorgasbord that is available to you in any particular situation. And it was one of those things where I'm so used to it, I hadn't thought about it, but when someone speaks about it in those terms, this is a person who isn't accountable in an elected way, it's not a particularly transparent process. That suddenly felt quite shocking to me in a way that I had just accepted it as normal before.
Well, thank you, Becky, so much for joining me to chat about this episode. I'm really looking forward to the next episode where you'll explore this same issue from the UK's perspective. And sit back, relax, and enjoy the episode.
The hearing.
Hello, Professor Reynolds. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
We're very happy to have you. Thank you for joining us. Before we jump into today's topic, which is, as you know, jury nullification, it would be great to learn a little bit about you. So would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a law professor at the University of Tennessee College of Law, where I've been for quite a while. I teach a number of classes. I teach constitutional law. I teach administrative law. And the courses that sort of get the most interest that I teach, aside from those, are space law, which used to be an obscure subject and really isn't now. And I am, I think, the only one in the United States at present teaching law of distilled spirits, which is just what it sounds like. It's the law of distilleries and distribution and things like that, which some former students of mine who own distilleries came to me and said, somebody should teach this. Nobody does. And you teach all the weird courses. So I agreed. And it's a big industry in Tennessee, as you might imagine.
Really, you're not too far from Kentucky, too. So
it's exploded in the last decade or so as well. So I enjoy teaching that. And I think the students would like more bourbon flights and less hardcore regulatory law. But we do get some field trips into like distilleries and warehouses and places like that. So it's pretty fun.
That sounds very fun. And that's both of those, both space law and distillery law. It would be great future episodes. We may have you back to talk about
I wish I could get some good field trips for space law, but that's a little more awkward.
Right. A lot of liability waivers for that one. And I think I saw in your background, too, you're something of a musician or a songwriter as well. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much a has-been at this point. I was very active in that in the 90s and around the turn of the millennium. You know, it's funny. I started doing a podcast back before they were cool in like 2005. And I did the music for that, the little bumpers and bleebles and stuff, as they call them. And that's not the last thing I did, but I kind of lost my mojo for it. But I did write songs. I was a pretty good song lyricist, and I produced a lot of, people usually called it techno then. Now that's become a narrow subgenre, but EDM is what you call it now, which I quite enjoyed and still like to listen to.
Yeah, well, you're a very well-rounded person between your kind of diverse interests in law and musical background.
Well-rounded, lacking in focus. I mean, it's all your viewpoint.
Fair enough. Let's jump into this. We invited you on today, and we're so happy you accepted, because we wanted to do an episode talking about the issue of jury nullification, which is something that exists both in the US and the UK. So let's start with just the basics. Could you talk us through kind of what is jury nullification?
Sure. So jury nullification is when a jury decides not to convict, even if it believes that strictly on the facts and the case presented in the courtroom, the defendant is guilty. And they might do that for a number of reasons. They might feel that the law is unjust. In the United States, back before the Civil War, we had something called the Fugitive Slave Act, that people were prosecuted for helping slaves run away, even in free states. And juries just stopped convicting for that, which was quite controversial, and led to some of the first efforts in the United States actually to limit juries' nullification powers. Sometimes we had similar stuff in Prohibition. Sometimes it's when the jury has a different view of the facts than the prosecutors. One of the most famous early jury nullification cases was both a U.S. case and a British case, because it predates the Revolution. And it was where Peter Zinger, the printer, was charged with publishing seditious acts. And the term Philadelphia lawyer was actually coined because his lawyer, one Alexander Hamilton, persuaded the jury that it had to be the judge not only of whether he had printed these facts, which was what the government wanted, but also of whether they were in fact seditious, and the jury returned a not guilty verdict. That was a big deal. If you go back further in time in Britain to the 17th century, you found juries sometimes nullifying, but often being punished for that, being locked up without food, water, or toilet facilities, and I think that was Bushell's case, and that sort of thing. But it became gradually accepted that juries had that right. So that's one reason. If they just think the law is unjust or that the facts don't support the government's case, even if they're true, other reasons may be that they think the prosecution is biased, that maybe it's a legitimate prosecution, but they think it's being brought for reasons of retaliation or from a political agenda or things like that. And of course, sometimes they're because the jury just sympathizes with the defendant, which may be in cases where a classic case is where somebody shoots their child's rapist or something like that. And yeah, they're guilty, but the jury's like, they deserve a medal. They don't deserve to go to jail. And then there are the bad reasons for jury nullification, which people bring up a lot, which are cases like the Emmett Till case, which is basically a lynching case where you had a racist jury in a racist county. With a racist judge and racist prosecutor and racist sheriff, that's pretty much the deal there, who declined to convict. And that's when people talk about jury nullification now, that example tends to weigh pretty heavily on them, even though there's a lot more to jury nullification than that.
Seems like, I mean, many of these examples that you brought up from, you know, the Fugitive Slave Act, Prohibition, you know, things involving, you know, racism, sounds like it tends to come up, at least in discussion, in these very controversial, socially contentious kind of areas, which is actually how we started thinking about doing this episode too, just thinking about the January 6th prosecutions and some of these very politically charged prosecutions that are going on. But that's what makes it so interesting, is you kind of tend to think, you might think of it being used in cases where you agree with what the jury is doing, but in the Emmett Till case, of course.
Sure. Now, one thing I will point out, and this is a point that I've made in my writings, and I think people sort of forget this. When you are put on trial in front of a jury, the jury can, if it thinks, for whatever reason, really, you shouldn't be convicted, it can refuse to convict. And people can't believe there's so much unreviewable power in the hands of juries. But in fact, before you ever reach the jury, your case goes to a prosecutor, and the prosecutor could do the exact same thing, and there's literally no real supervision over that. They could drop the charges, they could plead the charges down, they can just delay prosecution until the statute of limitations runs, and as an Emmett Till, it's not as if prosecutors can't be racist too,
right.
And certainly we're in that case. So I think that it's, I think people somehow are concerned at this unconstrained power on the part of the jury when there's so much more power on the part of the prosecutors. And of course, the jury's nullification power is partly there, and the framers of our Constitution certainly saw it that way. For that matter, even before the American Revolution, the general Anglo legal system saw it as a constraint on the power of prosecutors. Because when the state prosecutes you for a crime, it's directing its enormous power at an individual. And there are some constraints on that, and certainly in the trial thing, you have a lot of due process as well as the jury nullification. But in the American legal system, I don't know how true this is of the British system, almost all the real action takes place before we ever get to a courtroom. When the prosecutor decides what to charge you with, that's the big thing. Criminal defense lawyers spend a lot of time negotiating with the prosecutor over what the charges are going to be. And often they try to negotiate a plea bargain. And in the United States, I don't know what the percentage is overall. It's hard to combine. You've got federal and state, but it's in the high 90% range of criminal cases are plea bargained. So they never go to trial at all, which means all those due process rights you get in the courtroom don't apply at all. The prosecutor is almost completely unconstrained. I mean, that can get some bad publicity, which happens very rarely, but can happen. But there's just not much constraint. Judges also, of course, have a lot of flexibility in how they rule in cases and on pretrial motions. And of course, the police have enormous discretion on whether they arrest you or even just notice what you're doing at all. And none of that is under any kind of review. So it's sort of odd, I think, in a way, to focus so much with horror on the unconstrained power of the jury to let people go when every other participant in the criminal justice system has more of that power with fewer constraints.
Right, right. So the power of jury nullification in that tiny percentage of cases that are going to trial can be a counterweight to that power that the prosecutors have.
Yeah, and traditionally, and this is really just not true anymore as a matter of practice, the institution of the grand jury was also a constraint. Again, traditionally, the prosecutor couldn't bring charges normally unless the grand jury approved and issued an indictment. And that's not true in every state. The U.S. Constitution doesn't require a grand jury indictment except for federal crimes, for reasons I disagree with. But even where you have a grand jury, they're now pretty much tools of the prosecution. You know, there's a famous statement from Judge Saul Wachler in New York. He said, any competent prosecutor should be able to have a grand jury indict a ham sandwich. And that's fairly accurate. I mean, I know of a few cases where grand juries have refused to indict, but generally speaking, I mean, the prosecution presents its side. There's no opposing counsel. So it's pretty easy to make it persuasive. And because the grand jury serves in multiple cases over a period of time, the prosecutor and the grand jury tend to have a certain relationship that makes it easier. So it's, that constraint just isn't really very significant anymore.
Right. And for those who, you know, you mentioned there have been efforts to kind of constrain this power that the jury has. Well, let's start with this. I mean, are juries told that they have this ability? Do they know about it when they're sitting there in the jury box?
Generally speaking, no. It's fascinating. Basically, everybody agrees they have this power, but the entire legal apparatus pretty much believes they shouldn't be told that they do. And there are some states where you're allowed to mention that in closing arguments or even ask for that instruction. But as a general rule, you know, if you're an attorney, if you're a defense attorney, you make essentially a jury nullification argument and you make it very openly. Say, look, my guy may be guilty, but you should vote not to convict because you have that power. The judge may stop you. It's like, even though it's true, even though everybody knows it's true, the judges hate it. And it, you know, in some places you may face ethical sanctions or something for doing it, which makes no sense at all, but that's how it works. In fact, there are cases, we have something, I don't know if they're really around much anymore, but for quite a while, we had something called the Fully Informed Jury Movement, which was activists who would go around courthouses passing out leaflets, just say, hey, are you a juror? Because you should know you have this power to nullify convictions if you think it's unjust. And they were getting arrested, and judges were finding them in contempt for allegedly interfering with the justice system, even though what they did was clearly within their free speech rights. And they always win those cases eventually, but it sort of shows you how the legal establishment tends to respond to that sort of thing.
Right. And it would have a chilling effect just to try to prosecute somebody for that. You know, it sends a warning to anybody else who might think about doing the same thing.
Sure. And I guess you could hope the jury would nullify it if they did.
Right.
That would be sort of fun to take to court. Well, they went around telling people that juries had this power, which, by the way, we can't tell you about it because then you'd know.
Right.
That's actually quite amusing to think about how that would play out. But yeah, so that's, you know, jurors have that power everywhere, and there's a fair amount of case law on it. They're generally not told, which I think, again, is a mistake, because I think if you don't tell jurors that they have that power, some of them will still vote not to convict. What they won't do, for the most part, is sit down and think about it sensibly. They may vote not to convict out of an emotional reaction, but they won't do it because they say, okay, part of our job is to do justice here, and does this prosecution meet the test of justice or not? And I think that's too bad. I don't think that by driving this sort of underground, you do very much. I think it does improve the self-esteem of prosecutors and judges, and I think that's what drives a lot of this.
Right. If you were to tell juries about it, it would take out some of that arbitrariness of, does a juror happen to know or be thinking about this?
Exactly.
Maybe not.
And really, the history of criminal justice in the U.S., I'm actually pretty sure this is true in Britain, too, has been the withdrawal of power and even prestige from the jury in favor of repeat players like judges and prosecutors and even defense lawyers and police. And it makes sense when you think about it. I mean, the virtue of the jury from the standpoint of the Anglo-American legal system is that it can't be corrupted as part of the system because it's not part of the system. They're not repeat players. They're random people who get pulled in for one trial and then they're gone. There's no log rolling. There's no favor trading. You know, there's just nothing. So that's the great thing. But the downside is because they're not repeat players, they have less power. Prosecutors can do favors for judges. Judges can do favors for prosecutors and defense lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. The jury comes and they go. And even if the jury thinks they had a terrible experience and hates the judge or the prosecutor, unless they get somebody from a newspaper to listen to them, none of it matters. And even if they can, it really doesn't usually matter much. As somebody, I think it was Akil Amar, who's a law professor at Yale, said, if you want to understand the difference in actual status between jurors and judges, even though in theory they're of equal status, he says, just compare the opulence of most judges' chambers with the dreariness of most jury rooms. And that is really true. You know, I'm fortunate enough, I'm like a lot of law professors, to have sat on a jury. And you go to the judges' chambers are very nice. And the jury room typically has like a formica table, right, and some folding chairs and a coffee machine that smells bad and, you know, the usual, maybe a vending machine outside for snacks. And that really does sort of sum it up. I mean, the justice system is a system for repeat players. And there is a lot of favor trading over time among everybody but the jury. So there's been a lot of gradual marginalization of the jury over 200 years, which, as I say, really started in a reaction to the nullification of the Fugitive Slave Act and was accelerated again under Prohibition, also in a lot of drug cases. And in fact, you know, there are many parts of the country which are mostly, it's weird, they're mostly either very urban or very rural, where it's very hard to get drug convictions. So, you know, in big cities, most juries will not convict for anything less than colossal amounts of drugs, and usually there has to be violence involved. And here, in the area of Northeast Tennessee, up along the Tennessee-Kentucky border, I've had prosecutors tell me jurors just won't convict anybody there for marijuana or stuff like that because it's a big industry to grow it there. They don't think it does anybody any harm. And of course, now the whole country has sort of nullified the marijuana laws. Everybody just sort of decided about 5 or 10 years ago, hey, you know, pot's not illegal anymore. And it still is. It's on the books as illegal under federal law. And in my state it is, but nobody ever gets convicted of it. And in a way, that goes beyond jury nullification, almost societal nullification. Right. But one of the things that drove it too is juries just got to where they didn't want to convict on those kind of cases.
Right.
I mean, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, if somebody were smoking a joint on the main street in Knoxville and got arrested, the jury would happily convict them. And now, I mean, the jury would basically look at the prosecutor and say, why are you wasting my time? You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's driven it to a substantial degree.
And that's interesting because, you know, some of these more famous jury nullification cases, I mean, you can't ever know why a jury has decided not to convict unless they come out and tell you afterwards. So there may be some cases where the jury says, yes, we basically nullified. But in that marijuana example, it's probably nobody saying that, but the prosecutors know that they can't get a conviction. So it's a much more kind of low grade, but widespread maybe example of how jury nullification can work.
Well, and one of the things jury nullification actually does that's very useful is it provides feedback to sort of, you know, the establishment, I guess we could call it, about how laws are perceived. If you find that laws are being nullified a lot by juries, then you know that they're not popular, and you at least have the opportunity to adjust your conduct and maybe even your laws in response to that. If you don't, then you've lost a very important, possibly very stabilizing source of information.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned this at the start, and I just wanted to draw it out more specifically, but I think you said that the framers, you know, knew about jury nullification and they approved of it. And I was wondering if you could just expand. I mean, of course, jury trials long predate, you know, the U.S. Constitution, but I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on that sort of perception of it historically.
Well, one thing to remember about the framers is that they were, as a group, insurrectionists and, in some sense, felons. I mean, many of them were involved in smuggling. You know, the reason why the Fourth Amendment prevents general warrants is because that's what the British used to go after smugglers, and they didn't like that. So they were pretty sensitive to this, and they were big believers, and they were also quite sensitive to the issue of tyranny because they had just, you know, overthrown a king, gotten rid of, not overthrown. He was still king across the water. And they wanted to make sure the government would not be too overreaching. And, you know, this actually isn't from the framers. It's from Frederick Douglass, but it really captures their sentiment, which is that freedom rests on three foundations: the jury box, the ballot box, and the cartridge box. And the jury box was seen as a very important tool for limiting what the government could do. If the government can't convict the people it arrests for political reasons, then the government can't really be too tyrannical. So that's the basis of it. The framers very much saw that, and indeed saw also, you know, just as the U.S. federal government is sort of divided into three parts, the jury was part of dividing the justice system into three parts, because you had the judiciary, which was neutral, but supposedly careerist or career. You have the prosecution, and then you have the jury, which is the third part. As I mentioned, they're supposedly co-equal, which is not how it has turned out in practice. But that's what the framers thought.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
The hearing. You're an attorney with a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. With superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence, be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
If you were to bring jury nullification in from the shadows a little bit and formalize it within our system, you know, what might that look like?
Well, people have drafted jury instructions on this for judges to use. They don't get used much, but essentially they involve telling the jury that, you know, you're supposed to decide according to the facts of the law, and you're if you find that the prosecution has proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt and makes out a violation of this law, then you're supposed to convict. But if you feel that a conviction in this case would be unjust for whatever reason, you are entitled to refuse to convict anyway. You are not required to follow the evidence in the law if you feel that the result would be something unjust. And, I think that's, juries don't normally issue special verdicts in criminal trial. They don't say why they ruled what they did. There are some exceptions to that, but not a lot. Normally they wouldn't say, and the reason why we found not guilty is because we were nullifying. You could put that in the law, I guess, but it's never worked that way. As I sort of mentioned, I think that would be preferable to having people do it sort of under the table and on a ad hoc basis, depending in part on whether anybody on the jury knew that they had a choice.
Right. And of course, it could just be one juror, right? If you want to end up with a hung jury.
Right. It only takes one juror to hang the jury, and then they've got to go back for a retrial.
Right. Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about sort of the class structure of the legal system.
Yeah.
So the legal system, it's sort of funny. Lawyers are about lawsuits and criminal prosecutions the way surgeons are about surgery. It's no big deal until it happens to them. And then all of a sudden, they start sounding like their clients or patients. The legal system is primarily, the criminal system is designed primarily to process people as smoothly as possible. It is designed to take people who, in all honesty, are usually guilty. I worked for a criminal defense lawyer when I was in college who once said, well, 98% of my clients are guilty, usually of something worse than what they've been charged with. So it's designed to sort of process them quickly and smoothly into some kind of a punishment so the system can check them off. Now, is that a good thing? I don't think it is, but that's what it's meant to do. One of the problems you have with judicial oversight of the criminal system is judges, to a large degree, see their job as ensuring the smooth functioning of the machinery of government. And that's okay, except sometimes it shouldn't. Personally, I think it would be better if there were no plea bargains, or if they were at least sharply constrained, so that if you wanted to charge somebody with a crime, you had to actually prosecute them in front of a jury and convince the jury that they're guilty. Now, the objection to that is there would be far fewer prosecutions. And my response to that is, that's fine. That prosecutors should be forced to pick their cases, and they should prosecute murders and rapes and robberies. And when it comes down to the huge array of victimless crimes and regulatory crimes and things that shouldn't be crimes at all, in my opinion, if they don't have time or energy to prosecute those, which they mostly don't now anyway, that's fine. And so that's what I would prefer. And jury nullification would, of course, play a bigger role if more cases actually went in front of a jury. Right now, the possibility of it exists sort of in the background, mostly as people make plea bargain deals. It doesn't actually do a lot of work. It's just sort of a hovering shadow, a sort of Damocles of nullification or something. The other thing is, jurors are a sort of threat to the self-image of prosecutors and judges, precisely because they're just average, unwashed people who are supposed to be a co-equal branch. Now, having served on a jury myself, I'm not going to say that it was a bunch of platonic guardians out there. I mean, they were ordinary people. There were some things, actually, they had a lot of insight into that happened in the courtroom. They were terrible on the law, and they found out I was going to go to law school, and in evidence that their decision-making was not entirely rational, chose, therefore, to make me foreman, because I hadn't actually been to law school yet or anything, but whatever. But I had to call the judge and have him repeat the burden of proof standard twice before they realized what it meant. It was a civil case. And basically, there were a lot of people like, well, the plaintiff didn't really prove their case, but the defendant didn't really prove them wrong. So we should split the difference and give them half what the plaintiff's asking for. And I was like, no, that's not how this works. So all that said, nonetheless, if you spend a lot of time working with prosecutors and judges, and for that matter, defense lawyers, I mean, a lot of them aren't rocket scientists either. So when I took the bar exam, one of the guys who lectured said, if you feel you're just too dumb to be a lawyer, go down to General Sessions Court and spend a couple hours. Remember that everybody you see in there passed the bar. So, you know, the bar, so to speak, is low all across the board, and as in almost every field of human activity, including apparently the rocket science at Boeing. So nobody's perfect. And jurors, as I say, have their own insights that people in the system are likely to miss. So I think they should have a bigger role. And again, if it means that the system is slower and less effective in some ways at putting people in jail, I don't think that's so bad. One of the things the framers thought was that making the government jump through more hoops to do things would in fact make the government do less, which they saw as a virtue. And we see that in another one of my classes, administrative law, where administrative agencies make regulations that have the force of law with great ease, and the Supreme Court has recently made that harder.
Yeah.
And again, the framers thought if you're going to take the power of the government and force people to do stuff against their will, it should be hard. You should have to get a majority in both houses of Congress and get the president to sign it before you can do that. Or harder still, override a veto. So, you know, that, and I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And it does make certain people in the professional classes feel less self-important, but that's also probably an advantage, honestly.
Yeah. And on that point about kind of wanting it to be hard for the government, it seems especially salient when you think about the breadth. Just think of how many things are criminalized that many people probably don't realize. I mean, most of us are probably committing a crime every month without knowing it. And so it's
Harvey Silverglate wrote a book on that called Three Felonies a Day, which he claimed was the actual average number of felonies that the American commits without knowing it. And there's all kinds of absurd stuff, you know, picking up an eagle feather off the ground. You're not allowed to possess one unless you're a Native American. Doesn't matter if it was on the ground. There's eagles all over around here now, so that's actually like an issue. I suppose there are people actually doing that all the time and not knowing that they're felons. All sorts of regulatory crimes. Until the Supreme Court stepped in, you could fill in a pothole in your backyard and the EPA could charge you with violating the wetlands laws. So, you know, just all kinds of stuff like that. And in fact, when people have made efforts to figure out exactly how many federal crimes, including like administrative regulations with criminal penalties, there are, they've never been able to figure out exactly how many. It's thousands. So as you say, yes, there are a lot of them, and it should be harder.
Right. Because otherwise, as you've been saying, otherwise the power of the prosecutor is just enormous.
Well, they have tremendous power to pick cases. They have power to pick who to prosecute and who not to prosecute. And honestly, as a prosecutor, the power not to prosecute the people you like is probably the greatest of the powers. Even greater than prosecuting the people that you don't.
Yeah.
So I think that more supervision from juries and, for that matter, from grand juries would be useful. And I also think there should just be fewer crimes.
Yeah. Have you seen kind of the pendulum swing back towards the jury at all? I mean, I know this was big for Justice Scalia when he was on the Supreme Court, and there were that case 2012 saying ineffective assistance of counsel applies even during the plea bargaining stage. I mean, has there been a shift back towards the jury?
I would like to say yes, but I don't think there really has been a big shift. The current Supreme Court, in its administrative law decisions, has really made some moves that you could easily imagine sort of being extended to the criminal justice system and applying to juries. And in fact, as I always tell my administrative law students, the Justice Department is itself a bureaucracy and acts like a bureaucracy in all kinds of ways. There does seem to be a sort of back to basics flavor in a lot of these cases that I could easily imagine being extended to criminal law. And they've shown a little more interest in the rule of lenity and things like that. But I would, it would be very audacious of me to pronounce a trend at this point.
Fair enough. Yeah. I always feel like big criminal justice, this is the cynic in me, big criminal justice reforms or movements behind them tend to come once more privileged people see what the criminal, see from the defendant's point of view what the criminal justice system is really like, and then realize kind of just how unjust it can be.
Absolutely. You know, one of my former research assistants, who's a very successful criminal lawyer now, says that it's really funny because she'll get these people who are in for their third offense and will do really serious time, but they're people who are, frequent customers of the criminal justice system. And they're pretty unperturbed. And then she'll get some, you know, upper middle class executive who's never had any encounter with it. And they're generally shocked and horrified and appalled. And, you know, and as I say, just as with surgeons having surgery with, that's also true even with their lawyers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's been great. Any other comments or closing thoughts?
I think it would be nice if people paid a lot more attention to the everyday working of the criminal justice system. And I think it would be nice, though, these days, probably asking a lot to see better and more in-depth journalistic coverage of the criminal justice system and how it works and what it does, not just the outcome of trials or appeals or whatever. Because, you know, there's just, most people just really don't understand how this stuff works. To the extent they do, it's from watching TV shows like Law and Order.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you very much. That was really interesting.
Thank you.
The hearing.
Thank you for listening. And I want to give a special thanks to our intern, Jamie Stevens, for her excellent research assistance with this episode. And with that, I'll see you next time.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.